This episode of Remnant Radio is brought to you in part by our sponsors at Kairos Classrooms. Have you ever thought about learning a biblical language as a supplemental tool in your biblical studies? Well, Kairos Classrooms offers real classroom environments with classmates and a live instructor who can help teach you biblical languages, both Greek and Hebrew. You need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. The price for a single semester is crazy affordable for anyone, so check out the links in the description and use promo code REMNANT to get 10% off Kairos Classrooms. Check out Kairos Classrooms today. Discount code REMNANT, REMNANT, to get 10% off your semester. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the wonderful world of Remnant Radio. In this program, we are with Dr. Patrick Schreiner. We're talking about the Transfiguration, a new book that he's got coming out. You guys are going to want to stay tuned. It's going to be a great episode. You are watching The Remnant Radio, a crowdfunded show where we interview pastors, teachers, historians, and theologians from different churches and denominations. My name is Joshua Lewis, and this is my co-host, Michael Roundtree. Together, we want to help you break outside of your theological echo chambers. If you're interested in learning about history, theology, or the gifts of the Spirit, this is the show for you. Well, we're back with another episode of Remnant Radio. We're talking about the Transfiguration. Once upon a time, Jesus stood on a mountain. Peter, James, and John freaked out because Moses and Elijah showed up, and Jesus started to glow. It's a lot of great stuff in this text, and Patrick's going to walk us through it. But before we dive in, we want to remind you, the best way to stay connected with Remnant Radio is to hit that subscribe button, like the video, and if you want to be notified with all the really cool stuff that's coming out with Remnant, you want to subscribe to the newsletter that can be found in the description of this video. You click that and you'll get updates on when we're coming out with conferences, courses, all that kind of fun stuff, new episodes that are being released, behind the scenes kind of stuff. All that can be found in the newsletter. More information about Remnant Radio, that would be where we would encourage you to go check it out. This is our last day of the early bird discount for the course WSSM. So if you're interested in learning about that course, again, the best way to find information about that is on our website, theremnantradio.com, or check out the newsletter in the description of the video. Without further ado, I want to introduce to you my partner in crime, Michael Roundtree. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great. Super excited to interview Dr. Patrick Schreiner. Patrick, man, I love your writings. I don't care what it is, if it's Ascension, if it's commentary on the Book of Acts, or extra theology book on the Book of Acts, or your latest one on the Transfiguration. Guys, you got to just read his stuff. He has great scholarship, ties it into church history. And for those who appreciate good writing, he can turn a word, and it's pleasurable to read too. So
yeah, so many scholars are boring to read. You know what I mean?
That's right.
Like really not enjoyable to read. It's like you can pick a good book, or you can pick like an academic book. And Patrick is able to do both of those things. Like I remember all the illustrations used in the Ascension. Pretty sure I've used the hook one a couple of times from Peter Pan.
Lion King.
Yeah, all of them. They're just banging on all. You mentioned Seinfeld in this new one. I mean, I'm in.
That's right.
All
I
the
forgot
introductions
about that.
To your chapters. Dude, I think they're fantastic.
Side note: I'm going to see Jerry Seinfeld.
Nice.
Month.
Oh,
yeah,
good.
Yeah. I'm excited.
I think I said something about Seinfeld being the best comedy of all time. So
yeah, and you were like, if you disagree, you're wrong. That was the intro to chapter 4, I think.
It is significantly better than Friends.
There you go.
But we digress.
We could have some debate about The Office, but that's not the show, right?
The Office was good. So, but of course, we're here to talk about different things, such as the glowing Son of God on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Right.
And what in the world that means? What is that all about? So Dr. Schreiner, if you could just maybe just tell people a little bit about yourselves. Of course, I told them about some of your written works. Just tell them, I know you teach, you're a professor. How can people connect with you and your work?
Yeah, so I teach New Testament Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary here in Kansas City. We're all so excited. The fountains are red here because when we're recording this, the Super Bowl is about a week away and the Chiefs are back in it. So the town is going crazy. You know, I moved here. I'm a transplant, so you can call me a bandwagon fan, but it's a ton of fun to be here right now. So somehow I'm talking about football, but here we are. Yeah, I'm in Kansas City, teach New Testament, and just love to study the scriptures with people who are training to be in the church or on the mission field or just in some sort of ministry. So in terms of like how I got into studying the Transfiguration, you mentioned my Ascension book. You know, there's kind of major events of the life of Christ, his birth, his death, his resurrection. very important things, obviously, but I'm kind of doing a small series of my own on minor events in Christ's life, what I call them. And I actually don't think they're minor, they're major events, but we think of them as minor events. And that's events like the Transfiguration and the Ascension. And then my next topic, I think, is going to be on the descent of Christ. And so I'm hoping to write a book in the next few years about that. So
Did he go and preach to the spirits now in prison? And
yes, definitely, because the Bible said that. Yeah. Yes, yeah. And, you know, there's been a lot of, we don't have to talk about that one too much, but there's been some good work on that. Matt Emerson, you guys have probably interviewed him. And then Sam, what's his last name? Ranahan? I don't know how to say his last name, but he has a book on the descent as well. So there's good work going on that, but I think there could be more biblical theology done of that. And so I'm hoping to step into that next. But now it's the Transfiguration. You guys are getting the like fresh, I wrote this a year and a half ago. This is like one of my first interviews on it. So I'm going to try to remember everything. Here we go.
Fantastic. Well, this is we're glad that we're the first on the list. He was like, you know, set up all my interviews, but Remnant Radio has to be first. We'll pretend that's how that went down. We're the first ones. We cornered you at ETS and we were like, what are you writing next? No. Okay. So what, tell us a little bit about the Transfiguration. Set it up. We got viewers who are jumping on. They maybe be super familiar with it, but maybe run through it real quick for us. Synoptic Gospels, like kind of walk through, there differences with the Gospels? You know, do they have different accounts of the Transfiguration? Yeah. Just maybe kind of unpack it just in a kind of a biblical way before we kind of dive into the systematics and the different kind of application points that we get from the Transfiguration.
Yeah, so the Transfiguration only occurs in what we call the Synoptic Gospels, which is Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It doesn't occur in John, which is interesting because John was on the mountain with Jesus when this event occurred. I argue in the book, though, it's actually throughout the Gospel of John, like the images are all throughout. So John loves to maybe not tell the same narratives, but to have the same themes in the narratives in different ways. So I would say it's in all of the Gospels, but it's only narrated in the Synoptics. It occurs in almost the exact same place in all of the Synoptic Gospels, again, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which is just interesting because it's not like it's in the same chapter, but it occurs at the same place in the narrative, which it occurs after. And I think this is big for understanding what's going on in the Transfiguration. In every single narrative, it occurs after Peter's confession, after Jesus's passion prediction after that, and after his statement to take up your cross and follow him. Then the Transfiguration occurs. So if you're kind of following the narratives of each gospel, it occurs at the exact same point. And then you have very similar things that occur after that. What happens in the Transfiguration? Well, Jesus takes his three disciples, kind of his inner circle, up to a high mountain. And there's a little timestamp on it. It's after 7 or 8 days of saying something. He goes up to this high mountain. It doesn't tell us exactly what mountain that is, but he takes Peter, James, and John with him. And it just says he's transfigured and explains what that means. In some of the Gospels, in Matthew, it says his face shone like the sun. In Matthew, it talks about his clothes. In Mark, it doesn't say anything about his face, but it says his clothes became like whiter than any laundry mat could make it. All of the Gospels talk about Moses and Elijah appearing with him. Only Luke says what they were talking about, talking about his departure or his exodus. And then Peter, in all of the accounts, says something in terms of, hey, Lord, it's good that we're here. Let me build three tents or three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And it's while he is speaking. So it's almost like there's an interruption to Peter's statement. You know, Peter is always the one that seems to speak up. And it's while he's speaking that suddenly a voice comes from this cloud. And the voice says nearly or exactly even the same thing. I think some of the Gospels, it's exact, and in some it might be slightly different. But almost the exact same thing as we heard in the baptism. This is my beloved son with whom I'm well pleased. Luke says it, this is my chosen one with whom I'm well pleased. And when the disciples hear this, they're terrified. They fall to the ground. In Matthew's gospel, it says Jesus touched them and he said, get up and don't be afraid. And when they look up, it's only Jesus. So Moses and Elijah are there and then suddenly they're gone. It's only Jesus alone. In all the gospels, they come down the mountain. And the disciples try to do a healing. They can't do a healing. and then there's more passion predictions. And so what's interesting is all of the gospel writers, you know, if you know how the gospels work, oftentimes they will put stories in different places based on what they're trying to do in their narrative. But the transfiguration for each gospel writer, synoptic gospel writer, they wanted to put it in the same place. And so just tracing that out, I think, makes it important to know why it's placed where it is, and that helps us interpret the whole narrative. So that's the event. Again, it's called the Transfiguration, from this Greek word that we get, the English word metamorphosis, right? So you metamorphosize. We use that in the sciences for like a caterpillar that turns into a butterfly. That Greek term can just mean to change your physical appearance, or it can mean like an internal change. And so it's only used four times in the New Testament. It's also the same word that we use for like transformed. So Romans 12, 1 and 2, be transformed. You could actually translate that as be transfigured by the renewing of your minds. And then in 2 Corinthians 3 as well. So Luke, interestingly, you said, what are the differences? I could go into this for a while, but Luke doesn't use that word transfigured, maybe because it was used in Greco-Roman literature of other gods becoming transfigured and becoming like a human being. And so he avoids that term. He just says, I think he says like his face was changed or his appearance was changed. So it's only Matthew and Mark who use that word transfigured.
I always like the laundromat reference that you, I mean, the OxyClean got nothing on the transfiguration. Like that should be like the intro, I think.
I know. I didn't use OxyClean in there, but I actually thought of OxyClean today, and I was like, I should have used that. You should have helped me write this book, because
you
need more spicy things.
If you're looking for dumb illustrations, I'm your guy. Okay, so
Tide, OxyClean. Mark's basically like, this is a white that you can't describe, which I just think it's a supernatural white, right? Like, this is not natural light. This is supernatural light and whiteness. So
that's good.
So we have the story of the transfiguration. At the beginning, you said that the transfiguration, that you've been doing this study on like sort of minor events in people's minds that are actually major events, like the ascension, like the transfiguration. And so I'd like for, if you could maybe unpack for us, why is this viewed as a minor event?
Yeah.
Maybe some reasons that this is neglected, and why is it actually a major event?
Yeah, that's good. And maybe I would even want to nuance what I said already, but I will talk to you about why it's neglected and why we overlook it. You know, even as I was thinking myself about the transfiguration, I think if you ask any Christian, like, hey, if you lose the death, birth, resurrection of Jesus, what do you lose? Well, you lose like the whole gospel story. Yeah. But if you lose the transfiguration, we're kind of like, what do you lose? Because it's kind of, it's usually explained, I think this is partially true, it's usually explained as kind of a preview of his future glory. And so he becomes this kind of, I like to say, like a light, bright Jesus, not to be irreverent, but he becomes this like light, bright Jesus. And then he goes back to being normal, like just walking around and everyone recognizes him for who he is. And he only shows that to three disciples. Like, why doesn't he show it to other disciples? And so in one sense, it's almost like an actor has missed their cue, and it's like the future is revealed in the present, but then it goes back to the present. And so you're like, why did that need to happen? What's the point of it? And so I think one of the reasons why we don't talk about, we don't think about the transfiguration is just, we just don't know like what the point of it is in the larger narrative of Jesus's life. The other reason I'd say we might neglect it is it's a really symbolic and mysterious event. And so we've already talked about like he turns white and light and his face shines like the sun, and two guys that have been dead for a very long time appear to talk with him. And Peter's kind of mumbling about what's going on, and he doesn't seem to understand. And I would just say, typically, I'd say most Bible readers, they read the transfiguration, they're kind of like, yeah, like what is happening here? Like why this imagery? It doesn't explain a lot. Why is he on a mountain? Why is he only showing these three disciples this? And so I would just say it's mysterious and symbolic to us. The other reason, I could give so many reasons why we neglect it, but I think we tend to think about the means of salvation through the cross, through the resurrection, rather than the goal of salvation. So if this is pushing us towards our future and kind of the beatific vision, seeing the face of God in Jesus Christ, we don't, as Protestants, I'm as a Protestant, as a Baptist, I don't think we think about the goal of salvation as much. So maybe the transfiguration, we don't look at it because of that. And then the other thing in scholarship is, you know, there's been a huge turn, which I really appreciate. I've actually written on this. There's been a huge turn towards kind of the earthly, the embodied nature of Christianity. And again, I wrote a book on the kingdom emphasizing this, but maybe because of that, when we come to the transfiguration, it feels extra spiritual, like non-physical. It feels kind of like that old view of heaven that we're just kind of floating on the clouds and all shining really brightly and singing hymns. And so maybe even in our current day, we don't think about the transfiguration because we're a little hesitant of that view of this kind of spiritualized Christianity. And this seems to be kind of this like weird heavenly picture of Jesus. The final thing I'd say is the Eastern Orthodox Church has used this event to argue for deification, theosis. I've read some on that. It just depends what you mean by that. But I think some Protestants get nervous about that sort of language. And so maybe we don't even want to talk about this narrative because of the Eastern Orthodox tradition and its tie to theosis and deification. And so there's a bunch of reasons why we might neglect it. So you asked, though, why shouldn't we neglect it? And, you know, there's, it's such an important narrative for, you know, we go back to the idea of uniting the means and the goal of salvation. And so Jesus has predicted his death, but then he shows them his glory, showing that, you know, suffering will lead to glory. The cross will lead to the crown. And so it's really a picture of the gospel in miniature, because if we only think about the means of salvation, which is so important, but we don't think about where we're going, then we're kind of missing the whole point of everything, right? And so the transfiguration is kind of the gospel in microcosm, because it really takes place in this very dark narrative. Like Peter, yes, he's confessed that Jesus is the Christ, but then Jesus is like, hey, I'm going to the cross. The scribes and the Pharisees, they're going to turn me over. I'm going to die, and you're going to take up your cross. And the disciples are like, what? Like, what's going on here? We thought this was the Messiah. And then he shows him his glory, and he's like, this is why this has to happen. And so it's just really part of the gospel picture. And then even pitching back to, you know, it's mysterious to us, and it seems so heavenly and spiritual, but it actually combines this spiritual view of Jesus. I don't even know if I like the language of spiritual view of Jesus with this fleshly view of Jesus, which I would just argue we're getting a great picture of Jesus as God and man in the transfiguration. And it's not, they're not contradictory, which fits with the view of 1 Corinthians 15 in terms of resurrected bodies. We're going to receive new, he calls them spiritual bodies, but they're bodies. They're some sort of flesh. It's spiritual flesh upon them. What does that look like? What does that mean? Well, I think we get a preview of that in the transfiguration. So it ends up, I think the transfiguration uniquely ends up marrying all these things that we kind of like push as polar opposites. And it ends up balancing our theology of suffering and glory, of mystery and revelation, of heavenly and earthly, of I argue that you need to understand dogmatics really to understand this narrative, but you also have to understand the biblical storyline. And so there's just, man, as you know, like anything you study, the whole Bible seemed to click into place through this one narrative. Again, it's like the whole thing is there. It's about our future. It's about Jesus's future. It's about the past. It's about Moses. It's about Elijah. It's about creation. It's about new creation. It's about anthropology, ecclesiology, Christology, the nature of who God is. And it's like, man, it's all in this narrative, and it's packed into these symbols and these images. So I've been talking a long time, but
no, I tell you, my instinct is run straight to theosis and start talking about how this applies to us.
I knew you were going to go there.
I'm so evangelical that I'm like let's go. But I'm so like,
you know. We can go there if you want. It's
spooky
fine.
And swirly. I want to save it for the end because I think it'll be interesting for our audience to kind of pulling them in a little bit more. Because I do think, to your point, it is as important that we set up what this story is telling us before we run to the kind of application of point of how it just affects us. Because there's so many really mysterious things about this text. You know, we have Moses and Elijah show up, right? Yeah. So all the Protestants tell the high church traditions, like, stop talking to dead folk. And they're like, Jesus did it. Why can't we? And we're like, it's necromancy when you do it, but when Jesus does it, it's okay, right? Like, so we have no category for that. So Moses and Elijah show up. I copied this paragraph or two from page 36, sent it to Roundtree, and was like, this is fantastic, about Jesus being the new Moses, but also being the reflection of Yahweh. Like, there's so much really cool stuff. Can you maybe just unpack some of the Moses Elijah narrative and what's going on there? And there's just a couple pieces that we have to kind of, I think, get the narrative before we can kind of run to application.
Yeah. So I think I'll kind of give you what most people say in terms of Moses, and then I'll add what I've kind of added to this, if that makes sense. So typically when we look at these narratives, I think many scholars have recognized there's a ton of Moses echoes going on in here. So Jesus takes three people up with him on a high mountain. It literally says a high mountain in Matthew. I think it says a mountain in Mark. I might say a high mountain in Mark, but it doesn't tell us what mountain it is. But the point is, in Exodus 24, you have Moses who's going up Mount Sinai with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu. And so it's like, oh, yeah, this is like a recreation of that image of going up Sinai. And then, of course, Jesus is transfigured on the mountain and his face shines. And immediately when you think of face shining, you're like, okay, that's Moses. He comes on Mount Sinai. He comes down the mountain. His face is shining. He has to put a veil over his face. Paul talks about this in 2 Corinthians 3. So he's shining because he's seen the glory of God. And then it's all just confirmed in terms of Moses, because suddenly Moses and Elijah appear to him, and he's talking to Moses, and Moses, I think, is suddenly figuring this all out. Probably he's talking about the Exodus. Moses took them through the Exodus. And then there's even little details, like he goes down the mountain and he finds like chaos in the camp, just like Moses does. There's a person who's been moonstruck. He has epileptic seizures, and they can't heal, but Jesus can. So it's just the whole narrative is really repeating the Sinai narrative, which you should totally see. But typically, here's where I want to make a turn here, though. Typically, it's Jesus is the new Moses. In other words, he's the messianic son. And I think that's totally there. But in my book, I think maybe the big contribution I make is that I want to say yes to that messianic son side of this narrative. But I also want to say there's something going on in this narrative where Jesus is the one who Moses longed to see as well. He's not actually the one only coming up the mountain. He's the one who's come down onto the mountain in Exodus 24.
That's good.
Because it's Moses. So this is where you need to read the narrative carefully. Moses goes up the mountain and he sees something that causes his face to shine. Jesus goes up the mountain and he just from his own being shines. Does that make sense? Like he turns, his like he face didn't... shines. It's essential to him. He's not looking at anything. It is him. Mm-hmm. And so this is huge because the disciples are actually more like Moses, Nadab, and Abihu going up the mountain to see God, who is Jesus Christ. Right? This is what John says. You see God in the face of Jesus Christ. So they're now seeing who is Yahweh in the face of Jesus Christ, and it's his face, which is the face that is shining. Moses's glory is derivative. Jesus's glory is essential to him, right? That's some of the language I use. And so we can't just look at this as Jesus as the messianic son. I think we have to look at this narrative as Jesus as the messianic son and the eternal son, which is why this glory is not just, and this is my big argument for the book, this glory is not just the future glory that is given to him post his work on the cross, in the resurrection, in the ascension, but actually the glory that he had before the foundation of the world, the glory that he had before all eternity. And it's both of those things. And that's what Chalcedon Christianity has always confessed. Jesus is doubly the Son. He's the eternal Son and he's the messianic Son. He is doubly begotten, once in eternity past and once in the womb of the Virgin Mary. And so it's using those dogmatic categories that I think suddenly this narrative, you start to see this is Chalcedonian Christianity, like coming, I don't want to say coming to bear in the most clear, like the text that brings it in the most clear way, but man, you think about Hebrews 1, when he speaks about Jesus, right, is the imprint, he's the light. Okay, I'm forgetting now. I'm talking about this, but I'm forgetting the exact language, right?
The exact radiance of his character.
The radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. Mm-hmm. Where is he getting that from? I think he's getting that from the transfiguration narrative. And I think that's a claim to the deity of Jesus Christ. And so, man, there's so much Moses stuff going on, but this is who Moses longed to see. And I didn't even get into like this is Moses who was the one who longed to see the face of God. He actually asked to see the face of God. And God said, no, I'm only going to show you my back. I'm going to put you in this cleft of the rock and I'm going to only reveal myself in part. And now suddenly Moses sees the face of God in Jesus Christ. And so it's fulfilling all these narratives because, you know, all the church fathers talked about there's a movement with Moses from the burning bush to Sinai to asking to see the face of God, that's like this upward movement. But the final state for Moses is seeing Jesus Christ. And like now he sees the face of God. And that's actually the exact same thing with Elijah. Same rock, same place. And he has to see the Lord as well. So
I remember that, that preaching point where you go, Moses wasn't allowed to enter into the promised land, you know? And then the first time he ever entered into the promised land is on the mountain of transfiguration in Christ. Right. Like he enters into the promise as he's gazing onto Christ. Anyway, I think that's an interesting nugget there. Michael, I want to toss it over to you. I'm sorry, man.
Oh, no, you're good. So, you know, I'm just thinking about how, you know, this Mount of Transfiguration, so much more important than we make of it. And so what's kind of coming to my mind as you were talking was that, you know, Peter, when he could have referenced, oh, those times that Jesus healed the blind man, or, hey, remember when he walked on water, or remember when he rose from the dead. I mean, of course, he does do that. But like, in terms of his just kind of, the 3.5 years of ministry miracles, what Peter, the one kind of central one that he brings up is the transfiguration, 2 Peter 1. I want to read this. And what I'd like to ask you is, what does Peter's commentary about his experience post-resurrection now, what does his commentary add to our understanding of the transfiguration? So I'll read it to refresh our memory. We didn't follow cleverly devised myths, this is 2 Peter 1. When we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For when he received honor and glory from God the Father, the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory. This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. We ourselves heard this voice born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain. And then he goes on and talk about, we have this prophetic word more fully confirmed and talks about scripture. But what is Peter's narration of his experience add to our understanding of the Mount of Transfiguration?
Yeah, there's so much going on here. It's, you know, I talked about how John doesn't speak specifically, at least he doesn't narrate the transfiguration, but Peter, who is there, like in this letter, he does speak about it. And, you know, in the context of Peter, you don't know, I mean, I think we all assume, but we don't know it's the Father's voice. It doesn't say, that it's the Father's voice. It just says it's a voice from the cloud. And I think we all rightly assume, but just it doesn't say that specifically. So you have in 2 Peter 1:17, he received honor and glory from God the Father. Now, again, this is pointing, I think, slightly more in this narrative to his messianic sonship because he's receiving something from God the Father. He's receiving glory and honor before he accomplishes his messianic task to show the disciples, to give them hope that this is what is going to come. And so he's receiving something from the Father. The other thing to note about this narrative is that in 2 Peter, Peter is contradicting or arguing against those who are saying there's going to be no parousia. There's going to be no return of Jesus. And so this is the context where he's saying, hey, I'm not making this up. We're not following cleverly devised myths. Do you want to know how I know that the end is coming, that Jesus is going to return? Well, I was on the mountain with him. So in other words, he's using this event to pitch straight to the new heavens and the new earth to say, this is what it's going to look like when Jesus returns. I got to see a preview of that on the mountain. And so I'm not making this up. I was literally there with him. But what's, I mean, if I can just add to this, what's so cool is in 119, he says, we have this prophetic word more fully confirmed today. So in other words, I would say this in class, I think this is amazing. He says, you are in a better place, because a better place than I was even on the mountain, because you've actually seen the cross, the death, the death, the resurrection, and the ascension. And now I'm telling you about this event. So we have the prophetic word about Jesus's return more fully confirmed than the three disciples did on the mountain. Now that might seem like I'm downplaying that event. But actually what's happening in Peter's mind is he's saying, I'm telling you all about these events. And now you get to look back on them and understand them almost in a greater way than I was on that mountain. Because actually on that mountain, I was saying things I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what was happening. But now I understand. And so it's this event that confirms for Peter, yes, Jesus is returning. He's going to return in all glory. And now we can be even more sure of that because we live in the new covenant era.
So good. Hey, so, and I think I probably tangented off of this and tossed over a question to Michael. Why Moses and Elijah on the mountain? Like, it's certainly a literary device that shows us that Christ is fulfilling things, but are they just representative of the law and the prophets? Like, he has fulfilled these things? Like, why bring these folks up? And I guess my next question is, and we don't really know, but are they embodied? Are they spirits? Are like, I mean, that's like a weird question. I mean, I know you can't really answer it because the text isn't explicit.
The church fathers talk about this. They think Moses was like holding either his staff or the Ten Commandments. So that's how, because the church fathers are, they're like, hey, how did the disciples know what these guys look like? Right? There's no cameras. There's no iPhones. It's like, we all just assume they're these Jewish guys with like large beards, right? And it's like, how do we know what Moses and Elijah look like? And so all the church fathers are like really bothered by that. And so they think, what do they say Elijah's holding? I don't know. He does so many. I think they think he's holding a scroll, but they all think that they're holding something. I think, and many of them actually came to this, I think they just, like the disciples just understand who it is. It's like spiritually revealed to them. I don't know. They don't tell us how they understand it's Moses and Elijah there. Maybe it's part of the conversation that they're having. Again,
certainly they come off the mountain and go, Jesus, what the heck happened? He goes, oh, that was Moses and Elijah. Like, I mean, that's always an option too, right?
Even after the narrative, they're like, hey, I thought you said Elijah was coming first. I think they're asking, why didn't Elijah just stay at that point? And then Jesus is like, you guys don't understand. I told you Elijah's coming first and that's John the Baptist. That was just like a little appearance of Elijah. And so they're still very confused, but I think they understood. How did they understand? It doesn't tell us, but I think they understood just spiritually. Okay, that's Moses and Elijah. And then I was going to say, in Luke, they're talking about the Exodus. And so I think Moses and Jesus are like having this great conversation about the Exodus and Moses' Exodus and his own Exodus. And Moses is like, I'm getting it. And I think maybe even through the conversation, they're like, oh, we know who those guys are. That's Moses and Elijah. How did they appear? So this is where I'm forgetting it. I haven't looked at it in a while. I think most people, and I think this is in the scripture, I think most people assume they appear as glorified, that like maybe it's Luke who says that they had kind of semi or somewhat glorified bodies as well. And so that they're kind of already have entered some sort of glorified state. Again, how you fit that with your whole eschatology, they've got to be seen in some way. So even if you believe their souls at that point, something's got to happen so that they can see them in some form. And so, we don't know exactly what they look like, but you ask, like, why do they appear? I do think it's true. I think they represent the law and the prophets. And so if you walk through the narrative carefully, you know, this voice comes out. It's after Peter says, hey, let me build you three shelters, one for Moses, one for Elijah, and one for you. And I think the interruption of the voice says, no, hold on. You can't build three tents because we are not on the same level. In other words, you're still confused, Peter. Jesus is not just a prophet like Moses and Elijah. Then he says, this one is my beloved son. And as a Jewish person sitting there looking at like the most towering figures in the Old Testament, maybe like Abraham should be added to that and David, right? But Moses and Elijah are there and he's saying, no, listen. And then he says what? Listen to him. In other words, his voice is the one that you are to listen to. He fulfills the law and the prophets, but he's the one you need to listen to. And you've got, again, you've got to put yourself in the Jewish mindset there. They've been trained on the Torah and the prophets, and it's to the Torah and the prophets they have been called by Yahweh himself to listen. And now he says, no, this is my ultimate revelation. And so I do think it's Jesus is fulfilling the law and the prophets, but even more than that, he is greater than the law and the prophets. I think there's a ton of things going on. I think we don't need to just say one thing about why they exist or why they appear. I think it's showing that Jesus himself and God himself have authority over life and death. Mm-hmm. I think it's showing that these are servants to the master. I think there's something going on with there's three witnesses in the heavens and there's three witnesses on the earth. There's so much going on in this narrative. I think there might be something to, I think this is a cool thing to think about because Elijah, how did he die? Well, he was brought up to the heavens. He didn't die. So it's almost like Elijah is plucked down from the heavens and Moses is brought up from the depths of the earth. And so it's showing Jesus's sovereignty over all cosmology because he's bringing one down and bringing one up. If you kind of take that spatial view. So there's just so much going on there. As I said earlier, yeah. It's not just law and the prophets, though. It's that both of these figures long to see God, and now they see God. So I think that's maybe the largest point, is that both of these figures have these major narratives where they uniquely wanted a face-to-face relationship with Yahweh, and now they get that.
Yeah. Do you think that Moses had that before? Like, and that's a cheat question, but like the 30, is it 33? No, it's 32, right? Cleft of the Rock, Exodus 32.
32, something like that. 33, yeah.
Yeah, so it's one of those chapters.
This is my first interview, so this is where I get some of those details wrong.
Right. No worries. Yeah, I get it. So it's around that ballpark. It's in that address region. So hides him in the cleft of the rock, and you're not going to see my face.
Yeah.
Right. I'm gonna hide you, and I'll see. You can see part of it, and it reminds me of Jesus's saying, like, in I think it's John 6. Again, my addresses aren't great. You know, no man's seen the Father except you, he who descends from on high makes him known, and then it makes this reference to Isaiah seeing his glory. Right.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
We have all these references of Old Testament people totally seeing God. But he's saying the Father. No one's seen the Father. So when I understand the Exodus account to say that all theophanies in the Old Testament are all Christophanies in the Old Testament, because no one has ever seen the Father. Anytime that God himself has been seen embodied, that has always been Christ. So I'm curious, is this a reunion on the Mount of Transfiguration for Moses? Like, has he been like, hey, you look familiar? Like, what does this look like?
Yeah, you are asking like super deep questions.
Sorry.
That church fathers have, which is fine. I'm going to go for it. But I just want to let you know, like, church fathers have argued about this for a long time in terms of what did Old Testament saints see. Augustine Augustine disagrees with many of the people who came before him. So I was reading through this tradition, trying to like think like, what are they seeing? I think, at least the way I make sense of it, and of course I could be wrong. In Ezekiel, he sees a human one on a throne, but he sees a human one. And I think this is the same in Isaiah 6. I think he sees a human one, but it's like the human one is in shadows, or like there's a vapor, there's a fog that he can't quite like make out like what's going on here. He just knows it's a human figure. And so I think what I'm getting at is, I think in the Old Testament, they're seeing almost like a shadow of what Christ is going to become, what the Son is going to become in the incarnation, but they don't see like the full revelation of it. So I agree with you. I think it's a sight of a Christophany. They see the Father in the Son, but the Son has not become incarnate yet. And so there's a sense in which they see a prefigurement of that, which is why most of the church fathers would say, like, even when Abraham is seeing the three figures, or Jacob's wrestling with God. He's wrestling with the Son. Augustine, so this is why I bring up Augustine. Augustine says, no, that we should not divide the persons of the Trinity in the Old Testament like that. He says we can't always determine which person of the Trinity they are seeing, unless there's a good argument for it. And I tremble to say this, but after studying this for a little time and connecting it to the Transfiguration, I do feel more comfortable with saying it's appropriate, and systematicians can pitch back on this for me, but I think it's appropriate that the Son and the Spirit specifically in the Old Testament appropriate a form. And I know I use two appropriate terms, but because in the New Testament, it's the Son who's going to take on flesh, and it's the Spirit who will also reveal himself in one sense, not just in one form, but as a cloud, as a dove, as fire, as wind. This is all related to how the persons of the Trinity relate to one another in their eternal relations of origin, and that it's appropriate because of their missions that they would take on a certain form, and that the Father does not take on a form like that, an appearance like that. Now, just to be really careful, though, it says that God is invisible and no one can see God. That's true of all persons of the Trinity, right? So we have to balance our like Trinitarian confessions of their one and their three persons. There's distinctions, but they're still one. And so what's said about one of them is said about all of them. That was a lot.
Oh man.
No,
we love the Trinity.
We're all about it.
Okay. I have so many questions on that, but I don't want to get too far on a bunny trail, because I'll just start asking you more other questions.
And questions that I probably can't answer. You need to now like make sure that the systematicians are like, you didn't say something wrong here, but I think I have the categories in place. I hope I do.
I'm glad you said that. So I want to come back to the tabernacles. You were talking earlier about how, you know, Peter's trying to put them all on the same plane by building three tabernacles, one for the Moses and Elijah, one for Jesus. This is my beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased. And so God makes this distinction, God the Father, this distinction with God, the unique Son, the Son of God. So so there's that side of it. There's this mistake made with the tabernacles. But I am curious about excuse me, even the impulse to build tabernacles to start with. Why wasn't he like, I'll buy you a Slurpee? I mean, that's stupid, but like, was it about, you know, when Abraham had divine, like when he had the three visitors, right? Yeah. In Genesis 18, 19, whatever it is, right before Sodom and Gomorrah, he's hospitable to them. He provides for them, but why tabernacles? Is it a connection to the Feast of Tabernacles?
Yeah.
And if so, how does that help us interpret the meaning of the story?
Yeah. So it's shelters, it's tents. It might be connected, as you said, to the Feast of Tabernacles. It's a little confusing in terms of why three, like why didn't he ask? So the problem with the Feast of Tabernacles in my mind is that why didn't he, like, are they going to stay with them in those tents? Or like, why wouldn't he say, let's have six tents for all of us? Or like, what's going on with the number? It seems to be just for them. So I wasn't convinced of the Feast of Tabernacles connection. There might be something there, but I wasn't quite convinced. Other people say it's like tent of meeting, like literally tabernacle. Again, you run into problems with the numbers. Like, does he really think Moses and Elijah belong in the tent of meeting? That gets confusing. There's other theories. So I think I'm usually the type that is like, yeah, let's go all in on the symbolism. It means so much more. But I actually stepped back and thought maybe the simplest explanation is the best explanation, that tents are places of dwelling, and that simply Peter is saying, let's prolong this event. Like I am seeing Jesus in his glory, and I'm seeing Moses and Elijah, and can we make the end come now? Like let's kind of like in Acts 1:6, right? And when they're like, hey, are you going to bring the kingdom now? Like, is this the end? are you going to, so you have Moses and Elijah next to you and you look like no one can conquer you at this point. Let's make tents for you and let's make this happen. So I wonder if the tents are just places of dwelling where he's trying to prolong this event. Hmm. And actually so this is where you have to dive into the words almost like deeper. This is my beloved son is some sort of rebuke to Peter. So it means like, okay, he's not like them, but it also, if you double click on, this is my beloved son, I think it goes to Genesis 22:2, mm-hmm. when Abraham is going up the mountain to sacrifice Isaac and he calls him his beloved son. And so I think by saying, this is my beloved son, he's saying my beloved son needs to go to the cross. This can't happen right now. In other words, this is my beloved son and this beloved son is going to die. So it's affirming mm-hmm. Jesus's predictions of the cross. And therefore the whole narrative is Peter is, he misunderstands both Jesus's, I put it this way, his supremacy. He's not just one of three, he's one, right? And he misunderstands his suffering because he wants to make him tense. And and the father is like, no, this glory only comes by suffering. So you cannot prolong this event. This event will come in the future. You're misunderstanding the timing of this, which is, it actually fits with the New Testament. Yeah. Like they are consistently confused about the timing.
I think that's the best explanation, because there's a problem with if you're building three tents of meeting, because there would only be one. There's a problem if there's only three and not six tents for the Feast of Tabernacles.
Right. Right.
But this actually explains what God says to Peter, as you were saying, where Peter's thinking like, let's keep a good thing going. God's like, actually, he's going away. He's going to the cross.
Peter's like, don't tempt me with a good time.
Speaking of his departure.
Which, and we're cutting on Peter here, but I think we'd all do the same thing. Like, hey.
Heck yeah.
Let's go. Like, you are now glorified. It's time. It's go time. So, Peter, I think, says what we all think when we read this narrative, which is why it's confusing to us. It goes back to my beginning comments. Why is he being glorified in the middle of his ministry? This doesn't make any sense. but it's, like the large point of the narrative is to give them hope, because Jesus has predicted his death, and it's hope. I say in the book, hope by revelation of who the Son is, and it's he's the Messianic and eternal Son. So,
Amen.
Well, so we got 15-ish minutes, so we'd do damage if we didn't talk about like how this applies, this kind of works with us. I want to unpack a little bit of theosis. Audience might be listening. We've done lots of interviews on the subject. Dr. Jordan Cooper, I think, is probably one of my favorites that we talked about this on. He's a Lutheran scholar. Okay. Fantastic content. But to catch everybody up, when we're talking about theosis, if it's going to be orthodox, as far as I'm concerned, not that I'm the arbiter of all things orthodox, there's a difference between energies and essence. We never become the essence, but we partake of the divine nature as it pertains to energies. The East has a helpful illustration for this in that the iron in the fire never becomes the fire, but if you pull it out of the fire, it can be red like the fire is red. It can be hot like the fire is hot. It can glow like the fire glows, but the iron never becomes the fire. It just infused with the energies. And Athanasius, I believe, is, you know, God became man so that man could become God, again, is not confusing the ontology of humanity, but he is saying that there's some kind of infusion of the divine essence within humanity. So we would never say, like a Mormon would say, that humans become God, but theosis, this doctrine, which is, again, I'm not saying we should believe and everyone should believe. I'm not even saying Patrick believes. I'm just saying that's kind of what we're talking about. This picture is a human Jesus. This is Jesus in human flesh, and the divine, what is it? He takes his flesh down and lets his divine shine, but he's still embodied, you know? So it's like, there's something going on there. And what does this tell us about that?
And Moses, and just to interrupt, Moses and Elijah too are also glowing. So I looked up your reference earlier. It was Luke 9:31. Moses and Elijah appeared in glory.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Fill in Josh's point. But yeah, Josh, continue. I'll let you finish
I was just question. Thinking, like, you've got Moses, you've got, you know, Stephen getting stoned. His face is shining like an angel right before this kind of beatific vision of Christ sitting on the throne. So there's something to be saying about, like, when he appears, we're going to be like him. And, like, there's something going on. Can you maybe unpack what the transfiguration has to speak to our anthropology? Like, what participation does it have?
Yeah, that you... That was really good to walk through all that. I think evangelicals are Protestant evangelicals are nervous of language like deification and theosis, and maybe for some good reasons in terms of, as you walk through, like blurring the line between creator and creature. I feel uncomfortable with that. I think ontologically we have to affirm there's an unbridgeable difference between God and his creation. I think in some traditions they lean more towards it. This occurs through the sacraments. I think also in the Eastern tradition, and again, I want to be fair to my Eastern brothers and sisters, but it seems to sometimes take the focus off justification by faith, and maybe make salvation more of a process that I'm more uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
So there's parts in there that maybe how the Eastern Church has defined theosis and deification that I'm uncomfortable with. But as you point out in 2 Peter 1:3-4, it says we become partakers of the divine nature. John 10, it speaks of, it says that we are God's. In Psalm 82:6, Jesus affirms that. 1 John 3, it speaks of how when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. What does it mean to be like him? There's just so many texts where I think maybe some one of my weaknesses is I think I read, I'll just talk to you about my own weaknesses, but I read other traditions and I think I tend towards putting what I like of that tradition into kind of the categories that I already have, which might not always be fair, but I think it's just another way of describing glorification. Literally, like glorification is we receive some sort of glory. We are glorified. And another way to describe that, which the scripture doesn't use this language, but it's theosis. That's what the tradition has used. So I think as long as we define it well, I'm not completely opposed to using that language. Just we just have to ask what people mean by it. But you asked a really specific question in terms of, I think Jesus's body, yes, is a picture of what it looks for us to become partakers of the divine nature. Because Jesus uniquely, yes, he's unique in that his bright shining face as the sun is essential to him. But if we follow 1 John 3:2, when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. In other words, we're going to be more like Moses in that we will receive that glory too, but it will be a borrowed glory from him, but it will then glorify our bodies, and that we will receive that immortal, which is the language that I think the scriptures use. We become immortal like God. Not like God in every way, but we become immortal in the same way as he is. And so we take on some divine qualities without erasing the creator-creature distinction. So I think the rest of the New Testament, and Paul himself affirms in 2 Corinthians 3, that this is a picture of our future state. This is a picture of glorification. This is a picture of, if you can use this language, you feel comfortable, of theosis and deification. So what that means anthropologically is we don't know all the details, but they recognize Jesus and they recognize he's still in flesh, but it's some sort of flesh that's glorified, which again, we just don't have a ton of details about that. We have some language about it in 1 Corinthians 15, but I think they saw a preview, a picture of what all of our bodies will look like. And that, man, now my mind's going, but in Jewish tradition, it describes Adam and Eve as being created in the garden and glowing with glory. And so like, this is in the Jewish tradition that it's just like, this is how humankind was made. And this is what we're going to, I think, even in a better sense. So Jesus had to be the ultimate man, the final man, the first fruits of the glorification of all mankind. So maybe I'm happy for you to ask more specific questions. I think part of the problem with me not answering this more specifically is I don't know if the scriptures give us like more about what that looks like. I will say, and this will just maybe confuse you more, but it gives you categories to think in, which it's given me categories to think in, is it's interesting after Jesus's resurrection, he isn't described as having a doxa, a glory body in a way that he then seems to have after his ascension. And I don't know what to do with these details right now. I'm still working through. I put some of this in the book and I just kind of left it like, okay, I got to think through this. Help me think through this. But after his resurrection, Jesus appears to his disciples and they don't fall down like, oh, woe is me, like I can't stand before you. But that's what happens to, I think, Stephen and Saul and John in Revelation 1. When they see him, he's completely shrouded in light. Mm-hmm. That's post-ascension. So when he receives his body, and I think it's in some form his glorified body, I don't quite, maybe he's veiling some of that glory still. They don't recognize him. I mean, people always say, well, he walks through walls and he eats fish, so that's what we're going to be doing. So I just want to put a pause on that and say, well, maybe we don't get actually the full picture of his glorified body in the resurrection, but actually post-ascension and in the transfiguration is where you get the picture of the glorified body, which is, you just don't get a lot of details on that. And I think that actually might help us in one way, because maybe the point of the resurrection narratives is not to give you the details of the glorified body, which is where we always run. And maybe I'm not opposed to running there, but I just want to say, even as we went to 2 Peter 1, Peter tied the transfiguration to the parousia, the return of Christ, not to the resurrection body, interestingly. Like, he didn't mm-hmm. deny it was connected to the resurrection body, but the earliest interpretation of the transfiguration narratives, all of them we have, tie them to the return of Jesus. And whenever we hear about the return of Jesus in Revelation, he's the transfigured man. So maybe there's some sort of distinction that we need to make between the resurrected body of Jesus and the transfigured body of Jesus. Maybe it's the same thing, and maybe he's veiling some of that, but maybe there's a distinction that he receives the 1 Corinthians 15 final trumpet blast body in the ascension. I don't know. I was looking through church history to be like, am I crazy to think this? And Origen said it. So he's a heretic, but still, he said it. He thought something like this. So I was at least happy to see somebody else thinking along those same lines. So he talked about the different bodies of Jesus. So there we go. At least there was one other person I found who said it. I'm sure there's others.
It's always unfortunate where you're like, I just got to find someone in history, and then it's the heretics. And you're like, well, someone thought it. That's good.
Yeah, someone thought it. Yeah.
Different. Yeah. You know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about this this quotation from C.S. Lewis. Because as we talk about glowing, and I'm thinking about our viewers and our takeaway, I wonder how many people are like, I always wanted to glow like a light bulb. I mean, like, probably not a lot, like, really get that excited about it. So, it makes me think of this quote from C.S. Lewis in Weight of Glory. And he talks about that. And he says, And his conclusion is, we do not want merely to see beauty, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it. So when I read that quote, it makes me think of the beatific vision. It makes me think of Elijah and Moses, how it's just like their longing is just to see God. Yeah. And I guess it kind of puts handles on it for me, because yes, glowing for a light bulb doesn't really.
Right.
And so I wonder, like, when you think about the return of Christ, when you think about the age to come, when you think about all these sort of mysterious realities that are hard to even imagine, put some handles on it for us. Like, what is it about all that gets you excited besides not dying? Right? Like,
right.
Like, what makes you like, what is it that just floods your heart with hope when you set your heart on these realities?
That's a great question. And I want to riff a little on your light theme even to answer that, because I think that's a great point that people are like, okay, I'm going to shine. Is that a great thing? I don't know. I don't know. I feel like people do buy like creams to make their face shine, right? People view that as a good thing.
Yes, yeah. Michael does that frequently.
That's right. I have three girls at home, so I know about this. Okay. There's some sort of creams that make people shiny. I think though light, so I wonder if part of this is light is an image that we are reaching for that is both a created thing. So the Eastern tradition has distinguished between created and uncreated light. Uncreated light is like God's light. He is light, 1 John 1:5. That's not he made light. He is light. And so created light is, and he said, let there be light. So this might not make any sense. I'm just riffing on light, but, you know, when he creates light, I think according to Romans 1, this is showing something true about him. And I think if any human being recognizes just the beauty, I'm even looking outside right now, the sun setting and the light, like my wife's a photographer, it's like the golden hour, right? Where the light setting, if you're ever at like the mountains or the beach and there's like the sunset and the light is refracting, there's something almost like, there's something awesome in the true sense of the word about light that we can't wrap our minds around, that we see light and it's just like, wow, like that we can't understand how it's waves and how it works. And it's just amazing. And the scriptures use light as kind of this goodness, virtue, and darkness as right, the opposite of that. And so even to use that image of light in the transfiguration, I think it's just reaching as far as we can go with created analogical language towards the best state that we can ever imagine. That it's just going to be filled with light and we're going to be glowing with light. And if we think of it too literally, we're like, that doesn't make any sense. I don't know why that's good. But it's more, we have to think in more symbolic, I think, language. And so, I preached this weekend and I quoted 2 Corinthians, is it 4:17, this light and momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory. And that's Paul's language. And he's actually just been talking about light and Moses and going up Mount Sinai. But think about that language. This light and momentary affliction is preparing us for, or it's actually not preparing us for, it's not to be compared to this eternal weight of glory. So it's like light is compared to, or momentary is compared to eternal. And then you have this weight with light. And so it's like this eternal weight of glory. He's reaching for language to say, this light that you're going to receive, this glory, because I think glory is just another way to describe light. It is so heavy. And this is, you brought up C.S. Lewis. It's like in The Great Divorce, and it's like in the Space Trilogy or the Ransom Trilogy. It's even like in Mere Christianity when he describes the new heavens and the new earth. It's the reality is heavier than it is here. It's more real, not less real. And I think that's the sort of worldview we should bring to the transfiguration, that this body of Jesus is now more real, because when we hear it's like filled with light and his face shone and he can walk through walls or whatever, it's like, is that less real or is that more real? And I think C.S. Lewis is helpful for us. He says, no, what's in the heavens is more real. And so we're going to actually experience all of the goodness here in a better sense, in a more real sense. And that includes our bodies. Mm-hmm. That includes all of creation. So the sunset that I'm looking at right now is just a small picture of what we get to we see in the new heavens and new earth, this body that I have now. And the beauty of these bodies that we have, it's just a small picture of what we're going to see in the new heavens, new earth. And so I think we're always just reaching. And I think what's encouraging to me is that we can look at creation and just be so overwhelmed with the goodness of creation. But then at the same time, we're like, there's so much evil in it. And we just recognize that like he's going to push that goodness to a level our minds can't even conceive and erase everything that's evil. And that's what we look forward to. So I think the transfiguration, ultimately, I said in my book, it's hope by revelation. Hope by revelation, because it's Jesus who's the one who's going to accomplish this. And he's the one we ultimately are going to see, as 1 John 3 quoted a few times, when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is.
That's super good. I think that's a good takeaway point. That's a good place to, I think, to wrap in talking in terms of the exact radiance of the Father's glory. So like Jesus is the fullness of deity bodily dwells, right? Like that's a moment of radiating beauty and glory, but he's also truly human. He's truly embodied. So it's like all of the best human earth stuff and all the best divine stuff, like in this one snapshot moment. And we have right. these like literary pieces of beauty where we can see the good and the true, but then there are these moments of like beatific beauty where we get to see the beautiful, right? Like where, yeah. So like we get to see through the narrative story arc of God pulling Israel out of Egypt. We get to see the goodness of God. We get to see the law being given and the truth of God and like determining what is good and what is bad. And then you can certainly see beauty in the story, but there are these moments where, you know, beauty can be described, but it's like food. You know, I can tell you all the notes of the steak that I'm eating or the coffee that I'm drinking, but until you experience it for yourself, you can't really experience that beauty. So it's like the beauty of God is on display in this moment. It's the transcendental kind of encounter that we have at the mountain. So I love that. I think it's super good. Guys, well, Patrick, when does your book come out, man? Like, we could do this for another 2.5 hours, I think. I'm ready to just keep talking about the Transfiguration, but we've got to wrap this puppy. So when is this book coming out? Where do people get it? I saw you can pre-order on Amazon.
February 27th, I think it is. So we're talking early February, end of this month. February 27th, you can get on Amazon. You can pre-order it now. And I think they're going to start shipping because they said they just got, literally, I got an email today. They just got them in to the publisher. They've been printed. And then you can go, I think the cheapest place I found is Baker Academic, who's the publisher. Their website, it's like 30% off right now, maybe just on pre-order. And I try to keep it as short as possible. I think it's only like 160 pages. So it's not terribly long, maybe 170 pages. And I walk through biblical theology, systematic theology, and then spiritual formation. I try to do a lot of different things in it, so I hope it's helpful.
Well, I haven't had the chance to read it all, but of what I've read, it's fantastic, and it matches all the other stuff that we've read of you. So for those of you who are out there, I'd say pick up the book. I mean, this conversation should be, I mean, this is his first interview, guys. You know, he hasn't like memorized all the responses. So, I mean, if it's this good, reading the book's going to be even better. So go check it out. Go pick it up. I'll put a link in the description once we get wrapped with this program. So thank you so much for tuning into this program. Again, reminder, our course just launched. The registration opened. If you want to register for the course, you can do that. Best place to check that out is theremnantradio.com. Our early bird discount ends today. It's like 20% off. Check all that out. And then make sure to subscribe to the newsletter so you get notifications when we come out with shows like this and conferences and courses and all that good stuff. So thank you so much for tuning into this program. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you. And we'll see the rest of you guys next time, Wednesday, 4 p.m. Central Standard Time. It'll be fun. You guys see you then. Want to thank Kairos Classrooms for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio. And if you're out there, you've ever wondered, hey, I wonder if learning a biblical language would be a supplemental tool for me to help me in my biblical studies. Well, you need to check out Kairos Classrooms. They offer Greek and Hebrew classes that can help teach you and train you. It's a live classroom environment with actual students and actual live teachers, and they help teach you the biblical languages of Greek and Hebrew. And you need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. There's a link in the description, and you can use the promo code REMNANT to get 10% off. These classes are already crazy affordable, but with the promo code REMNANT, REMNANT, you'll get 10% off of Kairos Classroom. So check that out today. And thank you so much for Kairos for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio.